more powerful than willpower. That you may have a will or intention to do one thing, but the environment, if it's against what your ideals are, may divert you even against your own desire or own interest. So understanding that, we want to create an environment which supports what we want, not in a conflicting environment, not an environment that conflicts with what we want. If you want to go on a diet, what do you do with all the ice cream in your refrigerator? You give it to your neighbors, right? You don't want to keep it there, right? If what happens with a lot of people is they want to live a particular lifestyle, or they want to achieve certain goals, but their lifestyle doesn't support it. So like they'll go somewhere and someone will say, well, just make aphorisms. So you make aphorisms to be a certain way, but around you everything's different. So if your lifestyle doesn't support what you're trying to achieve, then you're always being pulled away from what you want. So in the practice of spiritual life, it's very important to have a lifestyle which supports you. And one of the most supportive aspects of spiritual life is called sangha, association with people who are spiritual. Now, I've had that experience. I've been to India many times and associated with many elevated spiritual people. And what my experience was, my desires changed in their presence. My desires became much more pure because of them, because that's what they emanate from their heart. It's emanating. And I'm sure you've probably picked that up if you're around people long enough that are not the right energy for you. It starts to pull you in the wrong way. So just as some people can pull you down, let's say lower vibrational people, higher vibrational people will pull you up. Sometimes they'll pull you up even you don't even want to go up. You'll just get pulled up by their association. It's so wonderful. And that's why it's so important. It's like their desire becomes your desire. So that's how association works. So another aspect of association is we are impressionable by what we see. So to give you an example, I had a friend who was very fat. He liked to eat a lot. So one evening we ate together and he ate 3 plates. Finished one plate, filled it up again. Ate it, filled it up again. So how many plates do you think I ate by his association?
3.
I ate 3 plates also. And he was twice as big as me, and somehow or other he inspired me to eat 3 plates by his association. So it's not even a conscious thing. It's just what other people are doing is affecting us. What we're seeing, powerful effect on us. How people behave powerfully affects us, even if we're not conscious of that. If you see someone with good qualities, it'll tend to inspire you to develop those qualities. You may see someone who's very peaceful and say, I'd like to be like that person. There's a saying, you can know a person by their company. Right, so there's a picture of, you know, there's a picture of if you're standing with a group and you look at the group, then you could say, okay, I can understand something about you by looking at the group of people that you're with, because I know these people do these things or think in this way, act in this way, so most likely you're acting that way. That's just natural. That's how we're socialized. So when we want to practice spiritual life, we need the support system that will help us. Because we have the tendency to forget what we know. Do you ever know something and not do it and just forgot? I'm not talking about just your shopping list, but actually something important. Like you told yourself you'll never do that again, and then you did it again, and you just... And after you did it, you remembered. Then you remembered you told yourself not to do it. So that's our nature. We tend to forget. And because the forces of this world have the tendency to cover us. That's called the three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. They have, and we feel that all the time. Sometimes you just feel passionate. Do you ever just feel passionate? You just feel it. Where did it come from? It could have come from someone you're associating with. And you don't even realize it. There's some environment. So because we have that tendency, it's very important to be around people who are practicing spiritual life, and it brings sobriety, and it clarifies our intelligence, and it brings us back to center. And it's a common thing. Business people have associations. People who have motorhomes have associations. Probably people who go bowling must have it. Everybody has association to reinforce their understandings and commitments to whatever it is they're doing. So it's no different with spiritual life. But in spiritual life, it's really essential. And my spiritual master said, 90% of the progress you make in spiritual life is because of the people you associate with, that you can't do it on your own. Because we're so highly influenced by who we associate with. So the inspiration to do everything we know we should do comes from hanging around people who are doing it. It comes easy when you're with them. Especially in the beginning. It's really important in the beginning of our practice. So find associations of people who are practicing spiritual life, to spend as much time with them, learning from them, being with them, doing things, service. Service is called seva. So doing service in association. You'll hear this word a lot, seva. Seva is... the idea of seva is we're always doing something. And we tend to be occupied in doing things for ourselves. So seva is service. It's not for ourselves. Right? The meaning of seva, it's not just service, but it's service to God. Service to those who are serving God. It's divine service. And so, it's a totally different kind of service. And it's funny. My spiritual master said, many boys join the ashram, and their parents would come and say, "My son is every day he's cleaning the ashram, but I could never get him to clean." Because it's a different kind of service, and it has a different motive and a different inspiration. Because it's not about me anymore. It's not about what I like to do or I don't. But it's done for God. So the idea of seva is we're going to act anyway. We're going to do things. But it actually purifies us, which is so nice. And then connecting with Dharma, what are your gifts and what are your talents? And how do you employ that in seva? That's an important... In level two, we go more into that. But it's an important thing to ask. How can I contribute? Because you can contribute to the world for your own betterment, for your own advancement. Or you can contribute for the advancement for a higher cause.
What is Dharma again?
Dharma can be translated as duty. It can be translated as essence. Sometimes it's translated as religion, but the way we understand religion in the West is it's not accurate.
When you said what are our gifts, what are our talents, and then how do you provide that in service, how do you find that? It just comes.
You may need help in finding it. Some people it's easier than others. In traditional systems, the teacher would help the student. Say, this is what your dharma is. The teacher would have that ability to see that. Sometimes it might require others' help. But one of the things that I've been taught is that if you go back to your childhood and begin to think of the things that you used to do and like to do, it starts to give some hint. Because when you get older, you get caught up in the, I have to do this because other people have expectations or for economic reasons. So they say if you go back to an early part of your life and say, what did you like to do? And then sometimes you have to explore that, because when I was young, I played guitar and I wrote songs. So then you could say, well, you're a musician, that's your calling. And I went further and I said, no, that's not my calling. My calling is a teacher. I wrote the songs to teach. So I had to go through it. I mean, I love music, but I realized that deeper down was, well, the reason I was writing the songs is because I had a message. Or I wanted to have, I think I wanted to have a message. I don't think I had one then, but I wanted to have one. I think the reason I came to spiritual life is because I didn't have a message and I wanted one. And when I got the message, I began teaching it. So that made me, by looking at that, I understood. And actually, when I got the message, I started teaching and I stopped playing the guitar. So the message was more important than the media. Yes?
Is it a lower quality of service if, let's say, you use your skills at your job and you make money and that money to give to the temple, rather than someone using their skills directly?
But using your money, using the byproducts of your skills? No, that's also employing the money in something that's going to be used for spiritual. Yeah, that's also there. But one of the things I would say is that if the work you're doing is so, it is not your nature, at a certain point, it's going to wear you down. And then at the end of every day, you'll just be drained. And that can have an ill effect on you. So it should be something which is, you know, it comes more naturally to you, ideally. If it doesn't, then at the end of the day, if you're drained, then you just want to come home and just zone out. You'll just, you know, you won't have any energy left. You'll end up in ignorance. Just, part of ignorance is just laziness and inertia. You know, just, I don't want to see the world, I don't want to deal with anything. So a lot of people are in that mode. I once lived in San Diego, and I drove down to Tijuana about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and the streets were just lined up with, I don't know what they call them down there, where they drink tequila. And it was like everyone in the city was drinking tequila, you know, it was just like beer time, you know. And looking at the people, it was, I could see that these people were doing things that they just hated, and they were just waiting for their work to be over, and then drowning their misery in beer. So that's the problem when people aren't rightly engaged and their life becomes, it's a dissonance, they become miserable, and then they start going down and relieving it with alcohol or drugs. Or come home and, you know, be violent at home or be miserable at home. So it's important to be in a little bit in touch with what our nature is. It's actually a principle. It's a principle of Indian religion. It's a basic principle called Varna. What is your occupation according to your nature? And that it helps you. To find that nature, that's not always easy. I think there's a lot of coverings that, you know, the social pressures and norms, and then we may end up doing something that we don't want to do, or we may end up doing something we thought we wanted to do until we find out it's not what we want to do. Sometimes it's too late because we happen to have a PhD in that. Right? And so, well, do I want to go and get another PhD? You know, I'm 28 already. Spend 4 or 5 more years, but sometimes that happens. Sometimes it happens when you're 50 and you realize, well, that was the wrong occupation. So if you can, you know, discover it young, you're better off. But that's a big topic. And we could spend a whole weekend just discovering our Dharma. And still you may not discover it after a weekend, but that's one of the things we would do, is you would go back and really look at what is your nature. And sometimes your parents could tell you, when you were young, you always were doing math, or you were always designing clothes, or you're always playing nurse, or, you know. Or when anyone was sick in the family, you always helped them, you know. So it's like, oh, yeah, yeah, you know, so you start to see. Like my daughter, she's a writer and a teacher. I can see that. It's like obvious to me. So I just, you know, encourage her to do that because that's what she does anyway. So I think part of the problem for some of us is our parents didn't do that. They didn't see what we were doing. They didn't, you know. Like my parents didn't see I was a songwriter. I would just sit around and write songs all the time, you know, put on my tape recorder, play, sing. And they never picked up on that. So they didn't look at that. But with my daughter, I can see that. She's languages. She's like, she's really good with language. And she's writing all the time. Write, you know, write a poem, write a story, teaching. So having that experience of my parents not keying into me, I thought I should key into her. So, but anyway, you could ask your parents. What did I do when I was young? What did I like to do? What was I good at? And so she's asking a question, well, what if I think part of your question is also, well, what if I can't see how to use my, what I do directly in service? Yeah, then you, so another aspect is you get something from your service, and then you use what you get. You might not just get money, you might get reputation. What if you became famous? Then you could tell people. People would respect you, and then you could tell them something that would help them. There's a lot of famous people do that, right? This is what I think about this. And people will listen. So you see how to utilize whatever it is you get. And that's the idea. Everything you do, you get some result. And where does the result go? Who does it go to? Go to you, go to God. Who gets it? That's the Bhagavad Gita, very beginning of Bhagavad Gita. You work, you get some result, where does it go? When you're the center, you want everything for yourself. And when God's the center, you want it for Him. And so the big battle is the ego, because the ego is trying to be like God. You know, they say that all envy is really envy of God. You envy another person. It's really that we want to be on top. But why is it envy of God? Well, He's the most beautiful. He knows everything. He's the most knowledgeable. He's the most powerful. He's the most wealthy. These are all things we envy in people. And it's hard to admit it because consciously we don't always feel that way. But when you dissect it, you can see that in many ways we want to be the center. I have a friend, a very famous musician, and he will admit over and over again that he got to that position because that's the position he wanted to be in. He's, you know, he knows that. He's not afraid to admit that. He said, I want that, and that's what I wanted. And he knows that's God's position. And he wants, you know, to get the glory for himself. But now after doing it for 30, 40 years, he's kind of over it. He just got nominated in Latin America for a Grammy. And he doesn't even want to go to the Grammy Awards. I said, are you crazy? He said, I was supposed to go to India and be with my son. I'd rather go to India. So because he has that spiritual intelligence, at least he came to that position. And he recognized it. So that part of, this is such a good point, because part of advancing may be that you're caught in it, but at least you recognize it. The problem is when you don't recognize it. So at least if I recognize, well, I'm actually trying to compete with God. You know, like one God's the enjoyer. He He's the creator. He controls everything. Do we like to control? You like to control? Yeah. You like to control? Yeah, we all like to control, right? That's God's position. And when we can't control something, we go crazy. That's his position. But at least if we recognize it, that's the beginning. I'm not the supreme controller. You know, I'm trying to control people. I want people to like me. I can't control that. I want people to say nice things to me. I can't control that. I want all kinds of money to end up in my bank account. How much control do I have of that? I make the effort, but it's not. I'm not the ultimate controller. So now when you practice bhakti, your bhakti means to show love for God, the very person you're trying to compete with. Now you're at the same time you're trying to love, and it creates this like contradiction. Because that desire to love is there in your heart. But there's also the other side where we're trying to compete. and they fight. And we're, you know, in as we're progressing, we're fighting with these two things. The natural desire and the conditioned desire. And you know where the conditioned desire resides? Resides primarily in the mind. And that is why in spiritual practice it's important to be able to distinguish yourself as a spiritual being from your mind, because your mind will say, I want this, I want to be this way. And your soul will say, I want to be this way. And now what do you do? Who wins? Well, often the mind wins. And what is the mind saying? It's saying what it's always said for a lifetime.
But the senses are demanding.
Yeah. Because why are they demanding? Because the conditioned side of us says, you live to enjoy. That's the purpose of life, to enjoy your body. That's what the conditioned side says. Enjoy touch, taste, sight, sound. And what else? Touch. The ears, then no smell, fragrance. Yeah, so we're in the body, the conditioned side is saying, you exist to enjoy. That's your purpose in life, that's the goal. Right? That's why you're here. And the spiritual side is saying, you exist to serve. Your intelligence understands that. You exist to serve. So now we're living this duality. And it's always going on, right? So what happens when you see something you like that's attractive? What do? You focus on it, right? That's beautiful. And if you focus on it too long, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, if you focus on it too long, then what happens?
You get attached to it.
You get attached to it. I really want that. And if you stay attached to it, what happens next?
You go after it, try to
enjoy
it.
Yeah, you have no choice. You have to do it. It's like, so there's a verse in Bhagavad Gita that said, if you contemplate something which you want too long, you get attached. That's called a commercial. Repeated commercial, right? Every night at 7 o'clock, the same commercial. So you'll contemplate it. That's called walking around a store. You're walking, all of a sudden you hit one thing. If you really like it, you look around, you come back to that thing, right? At a certain point, you can watch this happening. You could watch this happening when you shop, and you'll realize at a certain point, you're going to make a decision to buy that. But it comes after the attachment, the contemplation, the attachment. You could get a call from your mother at that point, say, don't buy that. It's not good. It's a waste. Every friend on the block could call you. At that point, you're going to buy it. Because you've gone to, I have to have this. No one can. So we live in a world that's alluring us, and then we live with a conditioned side that is very easily gets attached to something. But we're spiritual beings. And that's where this conflict comes. If we weren't spiritual beings, it'd be like, okay, cool, you know. just enjoy and then die. And then what's the problem? There's no karma, you know. It's finished. It's all over. Whatever, you know. Just the one who wins, the one who dies with the most toys wins. And just let's go for it, you know. Step on everyone's toes doesn't matter, because when you die, you're gone, and life is meant for enjoyment. But the fact that we're spiritual, it doesn't sit right, at least with anyone who wants to advance spiritually. So now we have to deal with this whole problem, that we have a mind that's conditioned to think. It's programmed. We believe that enjoyment, that's the goal of life, and then we believe that enjoyment comes from the body. So we have to reprogram ourselves. So enjoyment comes from the soul, not from the body. We have to change those beliefs. And then it starts playing out differently. As long as we believe enjoyment comes from the body, that's where we'll look for it. I mean, there is a certain level of satisfaction of the body, obviously, that we need. Otherwise, we'll go crazy. We have to sleep, we have to eat, we need so many things. But the problem is, I forgot to tell you, that they did a survey, and they found that people whose income was around below 60,000 said when they increased it up to 60,000, their quality of life was better and their level of happiness was better. And they said after 60,000, it didn't increase, or 70,000. So you might think, well, that's a lot of money. Well, when you have a family of three or four, it's no longer a lot of money anymore. But it's enough. So, you know, you can have medical insurance, you can have a decent car, a decent house, you don't have to worry. So they said after that, people's level of happiness really did increase after $75,000. So I think it's the same way that, in other words, we're spiritual beings, but we need a certain level of material comfort. But after that, it doesn't do anything. It's just, it has its limits. You've got what you need. Now you can practice your spiritual life.
That's it. I find that the anxiety increases for those who have a lot more.
Yeah.
That I was taking care of a lady who's like a billionaire in Colorado, and her daughters, they're multimillionaires. And the anxiety level was so strong because they had to secure everything that they had accumulated.
Right.
And so the anxiety was so much, everybody in the house was on lorazepam or whatever, that everybody was taking nerve pills.
Yeah, really?
They were like really in anxiety, yet in society they were like, you know, seen as envious, everybody right, was right. of them because right. they had a house in the mountains, a house in the city, donating wings of the hospital and charity, you know. But in their personal life, they couldn't even deal. They were just like, what is it that you do that makes you like, you know, what are you doing? You know, you don't seem to be affected by all of these things, you know.
Right.
And I was amazed because, you know, just being around them for so many years, like how upset they got all the time was... I needed the chanting just to be able to work.
And deal with them. I also heard that from someone who studied wealthy people, and they said that actually at a certain point of wealth, they actually become more unhappy. And I think you just enter in another realm of society and another level of pressure and another level of concern. If you reach that status, you have to be concerned about your kids being kidnapped, because that's
and
great.
A lot of their kids were all on drugs. I mean, like just to deal with all the pressure to like come to the point of the success that their parents had, and they were just like overwhelmed by it. But I've been caregiving for like 17 years with really wealthy people, and their anxiety level is amazing. I think that, you know, when I first was working for them, they're living in Hawaii with the panoramic view of all the surfers. They're like, this is, you know, but then their anxiety was just like so intense.
What I always thought about that was, with money or fame or anything you want, as long as you don't have it, you always think, when I have it, I'll be happy. So then you're kind of okay.
But if you've done it, then everything.
But you've got it and it doesn't work, then it's
like. What do you have to look forward to? Yeah, nothing. I've already been there. I've already done that.
Yeah. Your whole. Everything you've done, you've dedicated your life to, doesn't work. Now it's.
Yeah. I see that with my boss, or the owner of the company that I work for right now. Her portfolio is probably worth $150 million. Hmm. She's always anxious. She's always sad. She's always acting on emotions. She doesn't have God, family, children, everybody. Right. She lives alone. her sister suing her, her mother suing her,
really?
She's suing her dad's ex-girlfriend.
Oh,
that's
God.
Her life. She's consumed by this anxiety, and it's sad.
Yeah. I think I was listening to a lady lecture about the history of money, and she is a philanthropist whose job is to raise money, and she's traveled all over the world and lived with very poor people, very wealthy people, and everything in between. And in her study of money, she said that the original use of currency was to make things simple. Instead of bartering, you know, you have three pigs, and I have to get the three pigs to you. But I have to want something that you want, and you make bicycles. But what if I don't want a bicycle? So it would be easier if you just come with some other way to get the pigs other than bringing me bicycles. So in her study of this, she said that the use of money was never intended for people to get wealthy like they are today. That came later. It was just a system to go from bartering to have some other form of exchange that would simplify things. That's all it was for. Go ahead.
I always think it's interesting how things evolve, like the story you just told, or even the Constitution and the laws that we have in this country. And our founding fathers were so seeing, you know, why they came in, and they found this land where everybody was going to be free. And now we have amendments that are this big that we don't even speak the language legally. A lawyer can hardly read it. And we live in this world full of laws that nobody really understands, and it's left up interpretation, so we take everybody to court. And it wasn't really the intention of this land.
Yeah. That's, That's the nature of things. You get opposite results. And all these things are good. It's just good to be aware of these things and to see how the world works. And often, everything we want to get, we get the opposite. And all these discussions help just make us clear. And when we ourselves run into these situations, and sometimes we can see it clearly, but because we're conditioned, we may end up doing something like this, even against our better intelligence, and then we need to learn from it. Say, what happened? Why did I do that? Right? And then, you know, it's okay, the mind is dictating, I'm listening, so what do I do next time? I see that. I detach myself. So again, we come back to detachment, and Buddha is saying you won't be happy if you're not detached. And if you actually think about it, it's very profound, because everything in this world is going to be taken away from us. So anything we're attached to, eventually we're going to lose.
I find that when I learn things like that, I kind of start to get upset a little bit, and then that's where the acceptance comes in, our, you know, the control, and those are things I can't control.
Right, right. Right.
That's the world we live in today. But in this world, how do I live a better life?
So it goes back to that original point, be the change you want to see. And how, if we live the right way, we'll affect other people, and that will affect the collective consciousness, and that's the best we can do. Because we as individuals are the only ones who can individually elevate the consciousness of the world, and it won't go up if we don't go up. And my spiritual master said, I think he said 5%. He said, it just requires 5% of the people in the world to be God conscious. It will bring everyone else up. And they've actually done studies of that in businesses and offices, that a few people who are on a higher level will bring the whole office up, or vice versa. I heard they also did like a big meditation. Maybe that was the same thing. I heard something similar. I did a meditation and the crime rate, did it for a week, the crime rate went down. Yeah, so there's your answer. And as I was saying, very elevated spiritual people will tend to elevate people just by their presence. And my spiritual master said that many times. He said, people are much more influenced by what you do than what you say, because that's what they see. And when you're on a spiritual level, people feel that when they're with you, like she said, right? Mm-hmm. But people can see that. You're different. Why don't you get upset? Or I feel different when I'm around you. So sometimes people won't remember what you said. They'll remember how they felt when they were with you. And so that's often the power of a spiritual person, that when you're around them, you feel different. You don't feel like you've ever felt around anybody else. And so you know there's something genuine is there. And so if we become like that, people will feel that. And so that's how we elevate the world. And if we know that, then we can be more tolerant of the other things that we can't control. You know, the Serenity Prayer. You know the Serenity Prayer? What's the Serenity Prayer?
God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Yes, so that's the perfect prayer. Grant me the serenity to change the things I can. Can't change. The courage to change the things I can.
And the wisdom to know the difference.
Yeah, that's it.
The actual original prayer, Rama Lieber, it's a little different. It's nice that it's God grant me the grace to accept with serenity the things I cannot change.
Nice.
The courage to change the things I should. And the wisdom to know the difference.
Yeah, because that's better, because you're not supposed to, you shouldn't change everything you can.
Can you repeat it one more time?
God, grant me the grace to accept with serenity the things I cannot change. The courage to change the things I should, and the wisdom to know the difference. Lieber.
What's his name?
Lieber. He's a Catholic theologian.
Yeah, so that's great. And what should you change? Well, the first thing you should change is yourself. Do you realize how much we want to change other people? I wish they weren't like that. You ever think like that? I wish he wasn't like that. I wish he wasn't like that. I wish these leaders were this way instead of that way. But we should really change ourselves. Because we're the only ones we can really change. But the unfortunate reality is we don't want to change ourselves. We want to change other people. Because it's difficult to change ourselves. You know what they say? When a couple gets married, the woman thinks, I'll change him. And the man thinks, she'll never change. And guess what? They're both wrong. So, we need Ali Krishna to go on with our next thing, but since he's not here, I'm going to hand you something. And this is an evaluation sheet of where you are in your spiritual life. So I'll hand it out and you can do this. It'll only take a few moments. Well, it'll take more than a few moments, but we'll do it. And then we'll ask her to come. And I'll explain how to do this. And this is just for yourself to evaluate where you're at and what you need to work on. in your spiritual practice. So don't get depressed now. Don't get depressed if your results aren't as high as you would like them to be. This is just to show you where you need to work. So I listed qualities of a spiritual person who's spiritually realized. And then what you can do is you can grade yourself on a scale of 1 to 10 or 0 to 10 of how much you embody these qualities or attitudes. So if you put 10 all the way down, you're probably the Dalai Lama. Or you have delusions of grandeur. And if you put 0 all the way down, you probably need to see a psychotherapist because you've got a lack of self-esteem. So you're somewhere in the middle. And some of these qualities you'll find you're higher, you're more evolved, and some you're lower. And so the idea is just to do this, to give you an idea of where you need to focus on. So is that clear? Any questions? Okay, so just don't get too mental about it. It's really for yourself to evaluate your state. And maybe next year we'll do this again and you'll be in a better place. So when you finish, you can discuss with your partner where you need to, what you need to work on. That'll only take about 4 hours, right? And I'm going to go get Ollie. Oh, she's here. Oh, she's hiding. Now you tell me. Yeah, okay. So let's do 5-10 minutes, or 5 minutes, to discuss what you need to work on. You want to write anything on them? You write it on the chart? That'd be better.
What's in this? do you want to really get to the definition?
Is that okay?
Yeah, I was just wondering. The Prashadam's all in the
So what do we do? Heat it up or?
No.
It's all. It's meant to be cold.
Yeah.
And we'll eat it here?